Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Among certain people here in Mozambique, that the inauguration of the president may be an event with some kind of attempt to sabotage the inauguration.
Mozambique to install President-elect Daniel Chapo on January 15.
He promised Malawians that he would be able to fix the broken economy within 2 years. And if he doesn't do that, he will step down.
Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera says citizens will soon begin to benefit from his administration's policies.
It is only unity that can unseat President Barrow, without which it's going to be very tough, because we know the logistic aspects, the influence of the incumbent, and also tactics in which the incumbent will use in election and electoral processes.
And an independent parliamentarian calls for an opposition alliance to wrestle power from the Gambian president. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Mozambique, a researcher and lecturer at Joaquim Chissano University says expectations are high ahead of the January 15 installation of the president-elect Daniel Chapo. He will succeed outgoing President Philippe Nyusi, who has completed the maximum 2 terms. Carlton Cadeado says some Mozambicans, including the ruling party, expect positive changes after the installation of Chapo as the country's next president. But tensions remain high following the return of main opposition leader Venancio Mondlane, who had gone into a self-imposed exile. His supporters have been embarking on a series of protests after rejecting the outcome of the presidential contest, saying the poll lacked transparency and credibility. Some analysts worry the tensions and protests could ruin the inauguration of Daniel Chapo on Wednesday. For the latest political development, I reach Carlton Cadeado.
The first thing to be mentioned is there's a high expectation. And these expectations come within the Frelimo party, yeah, people from the central and northern part of Mozambique, as well as elite and ordinary citizens. They are all expecting good transformations after President Daniel Chapo turns president de facto and formally. This is one thing that is very well present in the political atmosphere these days. However, it is important to mention that there is also a kind of apprehension among certain people here in Mozambique that the inauguration of the president may be an event with some kind of attempt to sabotage the inauguration and the process of governance of the elected president, Daniel Chapo.
There have been a series of protests, and especially when Mondlane returned from his self-imposed exile. There are some people who are worried that perhaps the inauguration itself could be hindered if the situation is not brought under control. What are your thoughts?
There is this good expectation that everything will go smoothly and very well. But there is also this apprehension because there is some, signs of potential attempts to sabotage the event, the inauguration of the current president, especially taking into consideration this protest led by the defeated candidate, Venancio Mondlane.
The question some people are asking, Carlton, is that the Electoral Commission appeared to have not done its job well to ensure the election of the president-elect was smooth, transparent, and credible. And that is what has degenerated into these series of protests that people in Mozambique are seeing, which has left some people dead and many injured. Your thoughts?
This question takes me or whoever is taking this conversation to the causes of this protest. And my answer to this is that you have to see what are the causes, what are the conflicts, and what are the parties in this protest. Going to the causes, you have to separate causes and pretexts. If you take the parties of this conflict, the political players, you will see that the elections or the results or the allegations of fraud are the causes of this conflict. But if you consider the fact that there's a lot of young people and ordinary citizens in this protest, you will see that the causes of this conflict are social and economic situation that put them under uncomfortable situation, like poverty especially. So you will say that for those people, young people, for instance, the elections are not the causes. The results or the credibility of the electoral process is not the cause of conflict. This elections for them is just a pretext that they found to voice themselves their anger for the social and economic situation that they are in today's life, you see. But if you look at the conflict in the political sphere, you will see that this is because is the allegation of fraud and mismanagement that was attributed to the electoral members, or the electoral bodies would manage the electoral process here in Mozambique.
Do you see any of these concerns of these protesters being resolved anytime soon to ease political tension and restore peace, law and order?
Very good point. That's the very important point which we'll see in the first place when the new elected members of parliament take their seats on the 13th January. This is the first day that we will see the real test about the smooth or the quality of the inauguration, how it will go. Plus, that is the day we will see what are the expectations that the claims or the complaints that the young people presented will be addressed soon.
Carlton Kadiado is a researcher and lecturer at Joaquim Chissano University. He spoke with me from the Mozambican capital, Maputo. In Malawi, President Lazarus Chakwera says citizens will soon begin to benefit from measures his administration has implemented. This, he added, after fixing what he says was a broken system when he came to power in 2020. Swearing in his freshly assembled cabinet during his New Year message, the president also called on Malawians to give him a second-term mandate in the coming elections. His remarks come as the latest Afrobarometer poll shows that a majority of voters will choose the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or the DPP, led by former President Arthur Peter Mutharika. Chakwera defeated the former president in the last presidential contest. For analysis and the latest political development, I reach George Chaima. He is a leading political analyst and the country director for the civil society group called No Restoration.
What I know is that Malawians voted Dr. Lazarus Chakwera into the office of the president of Malawi based on his convincing, compelling, and persuasive campaign messages, which dwelt so much on fixing the economy of this country and also making sure that the country stabilizes in its everyday mandate, as well as a poverty reduction. He promised Malawians that he would be able to fix the broken economy within 2 years. And if he doesn't do that, he will step down. So Malawians were convinced and they voted him into office. But 5 years down the line after he has served this country, we see that the economic condition of our country has worsened rather than improved for the better.
But Dr. Chalmers, some people are suggesting that when he got into office, he realizes the situation was worse than he thought. So he had to resolve them before measures he has implemented will significantly bear fruits for Malawians to enjoy. Isn't this what political leaders do?
President Chakwera was the leader of opposition in parliament, which means he knew every bit of problem which the government had. And that's why he had the courage to come up in the open to assure Malawians that he's going to fix the broken economy. And I should believe that the promises which he made to Malawians were made based on the full knowledge of what he had in government. He should not have been surprised when he came into government to see things that probably he was not aware of, because he was part of the government. You know, the opposition side is part of the ruling government because he provides checks and balances.
But Dr. Chama, isn't it the case of politicians campaigning in poetry and governing in prose?
Well, in African politics, we have seen that this practice of changing statements after they get into government being very common. You know, during the campaign, they have different message to give the people. And when they get into power, they also have something different. You know, if we look at President Chakwera, what was happening in government, he was aware of all those things. And that's why he gathered courage to compile them, put them together, and utilize the weakness of the previous regime to campaign rigorously to convince Malawians to give him a second vote. But what we see is that African leaders, they don't match their words with their actions. And this is very discouraging in democracy.
Some people are suggesting that perhaps the president's call is too little too late, and that Malawians are making their decisions based on their ability to feed their families, which they said could cost him the election. Where do you stand on that?
Well, what you should know is that majority of Malawians are suffering. So people know that what Chakwera promised that you could do within 2 years was not practically doable. So this time around is when he's coming that he needed to do the five-year term fixing the problems, and the second term making Malawians enjoy the fruits of his fixation of the problems. So this is coming up with some contrary mind to the people. But I should believe that practically, what he promised Malawians would not have been done within 2 years because the damage was so great in the previous regime. He has tried, but I think he has failed to match his words with his actions.
Joe Chama is a leading political analyst and the country director for the civil society group called No Restoration. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I invite you to tune in to Border Crossings every day for requests and dedications Monday through Friday at 1500 Universal. And on Tuesdays, we have our Spotlight Artist of the Week featuring an interview and some music performances by some of the big names and some of the not so big names in music. And coming up on this Tuesday's program, we have Moira Smiley, who joins us. Make sure you're listening to Border Crossings Tuesdays.
In Uganda, the leader of the political coalition, the Democratic Alliance, or DA, is calling for constitutional reforms. This parliamentarian, Mathias Mpuuga, says will help ensure the next general election is credible. Some of the constitutional reforms Mpuuga seeks, including restoring constitutional age and term limits for the president, reducing the size of parliament, and electoral reforms to ensure an independent electoral body. Critics, however, dismiss Mpuuga's call, saying it appears to be a move to draw attention to his newly established Democratic Alliance. This after being expelled from the opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP. For more on his constitutional reforms call ahead of next year's polls, I reach parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga.
The kind of reforms I'm talking about are three-tier. The first tier involves overhauling the constitution. The major pillars of the constitution, by removing term limits and the age limit, were removed. So the major predicate, which was term limits and age limit, was removed over the last amendments to benefit the person of General Museveni. I am asking that this be restored such that we have a durable constitutional order. The rest of the amendments are about major threads of the constitution, the nature of government, downsizing parliament because it's very huge compared to the national budget and our capacity as the economy. Then the second tier of amendments relates to electoral laws. I proposed 8 amendments to a number of legislations relating to elections: the Presidential Elections Act, the Parliamentary Elections Act, Electoral Commissions Act, the Political Parties Act, and others. And the purpose is to ensure a free and fair electoral process. The third tier relates to the transition. The proposal I'm making is that before we go to the elections, all stakeholders must get to a round table to discuss the country's transition. The departure of General Museveni, and when he leaves, we don't want his departure to be a collapse of the state and therefore a total collapse of the economy and the nation.
Are you saying that the law as you have it now does not guarantee free, fair, credible elections in Uganda?
I'll tell you that we have a very big problem. Where the major actors in the election, the referee, which is the Electoral Commission, over time, the commissioners have been handpicked by an individual, and this is a huge center of disagreement. Secondly, some of the laws I'm proposing for amendment have even been litigated upon after the Supreme Court of the land. And the Supreme Court has advised variously to amend these legislations to conform to a multi-party democracy because they were made during a one-party rule, and therefore they cannot midwife a multi-party system to conform to the laws that can incubate a system that is multi-party in nature, and therefore they are not my own invention. I'm actually reminding the Electoral Commission to comply to the various rulings of the Supreme Court of the land in as far as these electoral laws are concerned, including the voting of Ugandans in the diaspora and the voting of prisoners, which the court has given a ruling upon as a form of disenfranchisement of these voters.
Do these reforms you are asking for have a groundswell of support?
I'll tell you that there's not a single sane Ugandan that has spoken against these reforms. The only voices coming through is that will the ruling party that commands the ruling majority accept to have a conversation over these reforms? That's the only question. And I'm saying we must put it to them that this country is not about them. It's about all citizens, including the minority.
Are there any particular dangers if these reforms are not carried out before the elections?
Eminently, yes, because then it will mean we are going to witness the same situation over the last cycle of elections, and you cannot call that an election. And that will undermine the building of a durable constitutional order. And that's what I'm trying to forestall by saying, can we have a conversation and put the military in the right place? Can we have a conversation and have the Electoral Commission independence enhanced and assured, such that there is trust from the actors on the role of the referee, which is the Electoral Commission?
Do you anticipate the majority side in Parliament, the National Resistance Movement, to embrace these reforms you are advocating?
I have spoken to a number of members of the ruling party, members of Parliament, and they have expressed warmth over the conversation. They are talking about the one issue they're talking about, that can we cascade some of these suggestions we are making, because we may not have all of them at a single go. And I'm saying there's no problem. Can we then have a discussion and agree What, for example, can come immediately and what can wait and be implemented probably in the next cycle of elections? Some of the issues actually require a national referendum. Can we agree on the nature of questions from a public dialogue that should be answered in a referendum of sorts? So there is an appreciation of the need for us to have this national conversation in the parliament and outside the parliament with stakeholders.
Parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga is the leader of the political coalition, the Democratic Alliance, or DA. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Kenya, the president of the civil society group called Public Service Governors, or PSG, is calling for an improved electoral system. The new system will thoroughly vet those who seek top positions in government, including the president, rather than only being voted upon during polls. Esther Waringa says the current system is not helping to get the best qualified citizens to effectively administer the affairs of the country. This, after expressing concern that elections in Kenya have been characterized by violence, tensions, destruction, and an expensive process. Esther Waringa tells me that the proposal of vetting leaders will ensure that those who go through the process will be required to also provide accountable leadership.
According to my analysis, the Republic of Kenya has not been an exemption of suffering democracies because of general elections. Currently, what we are going through, you realize that even public service delivery is inclined to political inclination and political alignments, which is really curtailing and compromising public service delivery in the Republic of Kenya. If I may shortly share the economic negative impact, is that during every election, we spend a lot of money. And I believe not only in Kenya, although Kenya, we are said in Africa to be the country that lives in terms of huge budgets that go into electoral processes. That is a huge budget. If translated into development, it will do huge development from infrastructure development of schools, where we have our children who are learning under trees. Other children are learning in very simple structures that have no roof. While as an economy, we are spending millions and billions of money to bring or to bag politicians.
What are the key ingredients of the new electoral system that you are proposing?
I am proposing a system where we will be vetting and appointing leaders other than campaigning throughout the country. We only set up a commission. For example, in the Republic of Kenya, and I believe this is what happens in other democracies, the president of the judiciary is vetted and appointed by the Judicial Service Commission. They don't campaign, they don't spend budget, and we get qualified, merited people who are qualified to be judicial officers. Now, when we campaign, the politicians, because of dishing out money, we end up getting the wrong people. Most of the time, who have no capacity or capability or merit to run government and government. So in this regard, I am proposing for a governance commission establishment that will be able to vet heads of state and government in the Republic of Kenya. Anyone who wants to be president will submit their credentials to the commission. They will be vetted at the full glare of the media. And of course, the commission will have set the questions, the everything that require that needs to be done in order to be able to know if this a qualified presidential candidate.
But wouldn't that eliminate ordinary people from being part of the governance process?
Thank you. I know in Kenya and other democracies, we have been experiencing the power. We have been enjoying the power of universal suffrage. But unfortunately, agree with me that from Kenya to Venezuela, currently in South Korea, you are aware of what is happening, and other nations, we have practiced the power of universal suffrage But like in Kenya, 2 years down the line, after general elections, remember that the Gen Zs of the Republic of Kenya were in the streets to impeach all elected representatives, from the president to everybody who was elected. And they called for an overhaul of government. And the question is, they exercised their power to vote, but 2 years down the line, they could not still trust the power that they had when they woke up early to go and vote. They wanted everybody they voted out. What has a beginning has an end. That is telling us that we are coming to an end of a process that has been budding leadership and have not been giving us the right leadership.
Esther Waringa is the president of the civil society group called Public Service Governance, or PSG. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In the Gambia, an independent parliamentarian is calling for an opposition alliance to wrestle power from incumbent President Adama Barrow. Almami Giba also says to effect change, all citizens must unite, forget about the past and focus on the future. This after local media reports say some opposition political leaders have begun talks aimed at forming a coalition ahead of the coming general election. Analysts say it will be difficult to defeat President Barrow without a joint opposition effort to back one candidate in the presidential contest. For more on his call for a united opposition, I reach parliamentarian Almami Giba.
I think it's enormous in any governance issue. Or the incumbency, no single party will be able to make victory. Looking at the current status quo in the Gambian politics, it is only unity that can unseat President Barrow, without which it's going to be very tough, because we know the logistic aspects, the influence of the incumbent, and also tactics in which the incumbent will use in election and electoral processes, where today in the helm of affairs is all controlled by the incumbent. Looking at the current status quo of the Gambia, the status quo of politics in the Gambia is polarized, and it's only unity call that will be able to change that narrative. We forget about tribal aspects, we forget about political parties, and we look at what do we do to salvage our country in order for us to have a leadership that will be able to defeat President Barrow, without which it's going to be very difficult. Because today, if each party wants to stand alone, and in the Gambian electoral process, it's not about a 50%+. It is a simple majority.
Is your call resonating among the opposition political parties to come together? Is your call resonating?
Actually, I cannot say it clearly whether it's resonating, because what I'm saying is, if you look at the contest status quo now in politics, each and every party is trying to put their structures in order. Most of the political parties in Gambia went through by annual Congress, except the current ruling party, the NPP, were unable to meet the demand of the IEC, in which I saw a letter that they wrote seeking for adjustment. So this is telling you that if political parties, most of them, six of them, have successfully went through a Congress, when the main political party that is ruling or in control of the affairs of the country cannot work on a timeline that is given by the Independent Electoral Commission. This is showing that when political parties join together, it will be success to the making in terms of changing this country. But along that side, talks are ongoing. You hear few political parties and few political leaders or few politicians calling in for a united front. But as the status quo is showing, it has not yielded dividend yet. But I know when the race is going tougher, people will realize that it is only a united front that can make change in this country.
Some of your critics are saying because you supported President Jammeh and you still support him, that is why you are calling on the opposition to unite in order to defeat incumbent President Adama Barrow.
I am a countryman and I believe in change. And that change can only be done when we are united, but not about saying, you know, I'm still supporting the Jammeh. I want, if it is so, I would say, no. I want to make sure that Jammeh's political party alone. But here, I am looking about the country's interests, not about Jammeh alone, not about the other political parties alone. It's about a call for Gambians. and we need to salvage Gambia, and Gambia must be resolved. We have foreign forces in this country.
People are saying you are just making the call without putting in the effort to talk to the political leaders to come together. And that what you are doing is just to draw attention to yourself. You are seeking attention, they say.
It's not about attention. It's about something heralded. Something had mirrored for me to say that. The current president or the current government want to bring a constitution that it doesn't reflect the life and the livelihood of Gambian people. So this was a discussion that I was doing in order to make sure we see the country first, make a change, have a befitting aspect, have a befitting book. This is what heralded for me to make a call. My call will only be known if each and every political party follows suit.
Almami Giba is an independent parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. In Togo, civil society and human rights defenders are calling for the intervention of the international community for the release of all political prisoners. They are also calling for more democratic reforms. Professor Ekwue David Dose is a surgeon and lecturer at the University of Lomé and the spokesperson of the Front Citoyen Togo Debout, a civil society group. He says his group seeks to ensure the respect for constitutional guarantees of freedom of expression and assembly. But supporters of the administration accuse opposition parties, critics, and civil society of willfully violating the law and then complain when the law is enforced. They called on the security agencies to continue to enforce the law irrespective of the offender's political affiliations or societal status. For more on the call on the international community, I reach Professor Ekwue David Dose.
We have many concerns about the human rights respect. We have many people in jail because of their opinion. We have some journalists which are out of the country because of their opinion. And we have many civil society organizations which are unable to organize meetings because they are supposed to be against the ruling party. So for this new year, it's very important that Togo also respect human rights. It means that we need to have freedom of expression in our country. We need to have very equal rights justice.
Concerning human rights issues, I have heard some leaders say that why don't you engage the security agencies like the police, the gendarmes, to tell them your expectations about the respect for human rights?
I understand the issue, but I don't know how we can manage it very correctly and very quickly. But I need also to say that next week on Monday we have a press conference, and in our statement we are calling the military, we are calling the policemen, and asking them to respect human rights. They are forces which must protect civilians. I don't know if there is some other possibility to say them and ask them to respect human rights.
What about the issue of political prisoners? Because supporters of the administration say that these so-called political prisoners purposely break the law. And then when the security agencies enforce the law, they complain when they are actually violating the law.
You know, about the political prisoners, we met with many agencies. We met with Human Rights Commission, National Commission, and they told us that, you know, in this file, there is nothing. Many people are actually in jail, but when you go and analyze the facts, there is nothing against these people. So it's clear that there are people in jail just because of their opinions. So we are asking everyone, we are asking every administration, we are asking international community to enhance the voice for the releasing of these citizens. Their place is not in jail. Their place is with their family. Some people are there more than 5 years, and last year, I think in September, we met with one of them, released after 5 years in jail. And he told us that at the end, he doesn't know why he spent 5 years of his life there in jail. Nothing was told to him. He was just released one day. He lost his job, and we were obliged to help him to buy some material and to help him begin something and to be able to take care of his family. It's not correct. We cannot accept this kind of situation.
Professor Ekwue David Dose is a surgeon and lecturer at the University of Lomé. He spoke with me from the Togolese capital, Lomé. Still in Togo, the Togo Policy Institute, human rights activists and civil society groups plan to commemorate the coup and assassination of Sylvanus Olympiou, the country's first democratically elected president, decades ago on January 13. Olympiou was overthrown on January 13, 1963. The government, however, has designated it as a national holiday, Liberation Day. But Mark Nda, the co-chair of the Togo Policy Institute, a newly formed advocacy and research organization, says the group will use the day as a moment of reflection and to advocate for more democratic reforms in the West African country. It comes as critics of the administration express concern about what they say is the shrinking democratic space, including human rights abuses. The government denies the accusations. For more on the group's plans to commemorate January 13, I reach Mark Nda.
This will be the 62nd anniversary of the assassination of Sylvanus Olympiou, the Togolese first democratically elected president. So we are going to continue for our organization to be talking about our president. We are going to continue to talk to our people using social media to educate them, to wake them up, to try to get them out of fear, and then in order to get our country back. We are going to have a few live events. There are other organizations that are trying to have our country have a 3-minute silence in his memory. There are also others that are trying to go to the cemetery in Benin, since he was buried in Benin, to put some flower on that. So we have participated also into doing that. So those are the things that we are planning, because in Togo right now, it is very difficult to gather.
What is the significance of this? Because people are saying that the significance has lost its impact, especially due to being overtaken by time and events.
Well, it is somewhat right, because it has been so long, 62 years, right? And we have been oppressed for so long that they have managed to transform the January 13 as a freedom day, you know, like the day that we were liberated. But it was the day that our first democratically elected president has been killed. He was tragically killed by a former soldier of the French colonial army, including the father of our current president, who later staged a coup and established a dictatorship. And then this day remind us the beginning of Togo's long history of autocratic rule.
Some people have a different opinion that the first president did not do things well. That is why he was overthrown. And to them, it is a liberation time. And that people currently voted for the president irrespective of the differences of how the election went.
Let's remember how the current president come to the power. In 2005, when his father died, our constitution said that the next in power should be the president of the General Assembly. The president of the General Assembly was in France. They blocked his plan when he was coming back to take power in Benin. He was freshly elected, and that's his first position ever in his life, freshly elected as a deputy in our General Assembly. the people protested and then took the power. And then to change the age, he was 35. You were supposed to be 45 to come to power, okay? And then they changed also the age so he can come to power.
Where do you go from here after the marking of this anniversary? Where do the people of Togo go from here?
This is what we're trying to do. Our constitution, Article 150, okay, the second paragraph, give authority to people. We are supposed to elect our president. So our goal is to organize people, re-educate people, re-encourage people. People are scared. People can't talk. People are in prison just for saying the country doesn't belong to one family.
Mark Nda is the co-chair of the Togo Policy Institute. He spoke with me from here in the U.S. Russia says it is closely watching the situation with Greenland following U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's refusal to rule out military or economic measures to take control of the territory from Denmark. As Henry Ridgway reports, geopolitical tensions are growing in the Arctic region amid rapid global warming.
Greenland has been thrust into the international spotlight. The vast Arctic territory is self-governed but belongs to Denmark. US President-elect Donald Trump this week refused to rule out military force or economic measures to seek control of the territory, necessary, in his words, to protect the free world. The Kremlin offered this response Thursday. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov.
We are observing this rather dramatic development of the situation. The Arctic zone is a zone of our national and strategic interests. We are present in the Arctic zone, and we will continue to be there.
Climate change is opening up new shipping routes and access to valuable resources, says Liana Fix of the Council on Foreign Relations.
That becomes increasingly a militarized zone where not only Arctic neighbors have access to, that's a Russian position that they originally assumed. By now, they also cooperate with Chinese coast guards. So the Arctic is increasingly becoming a zone of a great power competition and rivalry. And the United States is concerned it is losing this game.
Denmark says Greenland is not for sale, but is open to deeper cooperation with the United States. Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen.
I see a president who is on his way into the White House who has a heightened focus on the Arctic, and I can understand that he has that. We also have that from the Danish side, and we also have that within NATO.
Other European leaders rejected Trump's comments. French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot.
It is out of the question for the European Union to let any nation in the world, whichever it is, and let me say, starting with Russia, define its sovereign borders.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz echoed those sentiments.
The principle of inviolability of borders applies to every country, regardless of whether it is to the east or west of us.
Greenland's government, meanwhile, is pushing for a referendum on full independence and says only its own people will decide Greenland's future. Henry Ridgwell, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In keeping with the long tradition of China to commence its diplomatic contacts each year by a visit to the African continent, Foreign Minister of China Wang Yi undertook a four-nation tour of Namibia, Republic of the Congo, Brazzaville, Chad, and ended in Nigeria. The gist of the discussions in all four countries relate to the determination of both sides for China to strengthen its economic and development relations with the African continent. This relates to the question of trade, as well as to tackle the issue of import-export imbalance. Also, the matter of transfer of technology. And then also, as Foreign Minister Wang Yi said, for China and Africa to coordinate their political initiative, as well as security concerns. So in Namibia, the foreign minister met with the current president, who will soon vacate office, in Windhoek, and also with the elected president, the first woman in Namibia, and they also discussed the important issue of the export of mineral resources to China. Interestingly, prior to the election of the first woman in Namibia, there were reports that many Western corporations were hoping that if SWAPO should lose, they would ask the incoming government to review its mining contracts with China and open it to new bidding. Now that has all been put aside because SWAPO won the election. The visit to the Republic of the Congo Brazzaville must substantive because the president of the Congo may well be the next host of the FOCA meeting, that is the Africa-China relations. And therefore, they had to discuss the implementation of the last FOCA meeting and as dealt with the preparation for the next. So that was part of the discussion in Brazzaville. Significantly, because of Congo-Brazzaville's connection with the Belt and Road Initiative of China, it has been benefited enormously from increased trade with China. It also turned out that under the Belt and Road, the infrastructural developments in Congo-Brazzaville has matured to the stage where you can say, with the help of China, Congo-Brazzaville has laid the foundation for industrialization. This is very good because one of the tasks facing all of Africa is how to prepare the way for industrialization, without which Africa will continue to have difficulties finding jobs for young people when they graduate. In Chad, which is going through now some problems with China, its colonizer, welcoming Wang Yi maybe have been a relaxation. Chad is also trying to strengthen its relations with China and to cope with what might be the security implication when, at the request of Chad, France will be compelled to withdraw its troops. While the foreign minister of China was there, an incident occurred where the president of China issued a statement that the African states, Francophone states, have not been appreciative of the assistance that they have received from France. In a rebuttal, the leader of Chad reminded the French president that they have not received, got any appreciation for the thousands of French-speaking African troops that contributed to the victory of France in the Second World War. After Chad, the last stop was Nigeria. And in Nigeria, a similar pattern occurred, developing close trade relations with China. And in the case of Nigeria, to deal with the imbalance that Nigeria faces. So it has been agreed that both China and Nigeria will use their local currency in the swap of their trade. And according to the Nigerian information about the trip, Nigeria was very pleased with the discussions with China and they look forward to a fruitful cooperation. So this is a very important initiative which China has always undertaken. And we look forward to the second stage of China's commitment to help Africa end poverty. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
But tonight I'm out here with you, my baby. I love perfect timing, cause when I bless my eyes on you, not to put my mikono you daily. And let the blessings fall on me. I'm in the zone while she whine on me. Hey, give it to me, baby, so slowly. I need tara
too much care, my dear. Waka waka wa Sunday, my dear.
Hug a smell up all on me. She liking how I ride the beat. I whisper loving in her ear slowly. Journey cool, baby. I'm gon' go need, baby. I only need potency, girl. My baby, don't you worry. Ball in my arms and twirl. My baby, push it on. Cause I talk open that way with every single love in day. I'm on my way, making sure my level straight. And I don't want nobody that's gon' be up in my way. I got my baby, she my baby. Open that way with every single loving day. I'm on my way, making sure my level straight. And I don't want nobody that's gonna be up in my way. I got my baby, she my baby.
Was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a juicy bone has no use to a dog without teeth. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa. My heart and my head with you, walking kutaka. Who's the washer? Now, Kim Taka.